This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And happy holidays, everybody. It's getting closer. It's December 7th here in Charlottesville. Might be December 8th somewhere else already. This is the Sunday morning wake-up call, 91.9 and Richmond's 103.1. Get ready. Stretch out those dialing fingers if you want to call in and ask questions or make comments. Our guest today is David Toscano. He's the representative to the Virginia House of Delegates. Sometime developments. We always have our questions. Virginia House of Delegates from the 57th District, which is Charlottesville and part of Albemarle County. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm wide awake, and so are you.
Yes. I didn't even have any coffee.
I know.
Again, David Toscano here with us today. In your fifth term, right?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I want to say it is, but I guess it's really not, right? Once you get elected once, or certainly the second time, then it's kind of hard to get rid of you.
Well, you know, and it's also strange because of the way that the districts are drawn. They're drawn to favor incumbents. And, that's one of the issues that I continue to harp on is that, in a democracy, the constituents are supposed to choose their elected officials, not the other way around. And unfortunately, the way it works in Virginia is that we've got incumbents drawing these electoral lines, and as a result, incumbents are favored. Now, I'm in the minority, but I just happen to be in a district that is very heavily Democratic. And it's very difficult, I think, for a Republican to mount a serious challenge just because of the way that the lines were drawn.
And that is, not that I would like you to be voted out. I'm a fan of David Toscano's, and I think you represent many of the beliefs that I represent or wish to take place. But the way when you talk about gerrymandering, and we talked about this on the program with Bob Gibson several weeks ago, is your district will probably remain as it is because of the way Charlottesville Albemarle typically votes in terms of Democratic and Republican. And it seems like as long as the Republican organization is in power in the state of Virginia doing the lines, they want all the Democrats to be clumped together, and that happens to be in the David Toscano district.
That's right. And in fact, when the last redistricting occurred, my district just became bluer because they were trying to force as many Democrats into my district so that they could make the districts right around here safer for Republicans. Now, of course, there are some challenges to that, and in fact, the courts have recently ruled that our congressional line drawing was unconstitutional, and particularly in the 3rd Congressional District, which has an African-American representative, but the Republicans packed so many Democrats into that district that their lines were challenged. And now we've got a court fight, and we may have to redraw the lines for the congressional districts. Of course, the same logic can be used for our districts, and there could be some rationale for us having to be forced to redraw our own lines for our House districts.
Definitely some oddities if someone were to take the time to look at how the districts are shaped. I believe whether you're talking about state or national, I believe our delegate for this much of this area, Robert Hurt, his district is sort of a pencil that goes from Danville up to Charlottesville. The case you were talking about, Mr. Toscano, goes from, I believe, Virginia to Petersburg, right? And sort of has little circles around the more African-American sections of Virginia Beach, and then it's a thin line, and then a little more circle around Newport News, and then it takes a little turn to the left and goes around Petersburg, correct?
It is a very strange district. Now, my district is very compact, shall we say. I mean, the city of Charlottesville is 10 square miles, and the area in Albemarle that I represent, which I think I have more of Albemarle than any one delegate, is pretty much in the urban ring. So my district pretty much looks like a circle, which is kind of your model district. But there are a lot of districts around there that are drawn in really strange ways so that the incumbents can stay in power.
David Toscano is our guest today on the wake-up call from the Virginia House of Delegates. He's also the Democratic leader, correct? Or as some would say, the minority leader.
Democratic leader, I like to use.
You like minority to use that better?
Minority leader, some people use.
Depends on, I guess, how you want that to sound when you say it. So the Democratic leader in the Virginia House of Delegates. So I think January 14th is the start of the new legislature session.
Yes, sir.
So let's talk a little bit about what will be upcoming in this session. One of the big issues is going to be ethics.
Absolutely. You know, and we need to have a government that people can trust. And the Democrats in the House of Delegates are going to be pushing a series of ethics changes that hopefully will restore some of the trust in the aftermath of the McDonald's scandal, trial, and conviction. There are a lot of things about Virginia that are different than other states. Some are good, some are bad. But a number of us feel that this notion that we can take unlimited gifts from people is an anathema in this day, you know, that there's too much money in politics anyway, and when you have the possibility that people can give you as much as they want, and all you have to do is report it, it's a problem. You know, we've got legislators that are taking trips to faraway places paid for by lobbyists that may or may not be related to their official duties. You know, I can understand if somebody goes on a fact-finding tour to determine whether or not uranium mining makes sense in Pennsylvania County. But, you know, if somebody wants to pay for me to go to the Masters, you know, I'd love to learn more about my putting stroke, but I don't think it's appropriate for Dominion to pay for me to go to learn about that. And so that's what you get into. And I think the governor has made ethics reform one of his top priorities, and you're going to see ethics reform being debated, and hopefully we'll have some changes coming out of this General Assembly session.
So what is currently allowed? You said that some things are good, some things are bad. Is there, and as long as you or I report what we're given, is there anything that is not allowed yet if I report it?
Well, right now, last year we passed a little law that said that lobbyists can't give delegates or senators gifts in excess of $250. It's an absolute prohibition. But there's no prohibition in terms of so-called intangible gifts, which would be money. And all you have to do is report what is given to you if it's in excess of a certain amount. A lot of us feel that there's no reason why we should be taking intangible gifts from people, and that it creates an impression or potentially even a reality that you're being influenced by the gifts that you're being given. The thing that, you know, you always have to watch out for in this is that, you know, and this is a former sociologist talking here, you know, gifts and the exchange of gifts is an important element of relationships people establish. You know, you and I, if we get to know each other and we're friends, you know, we exchange gifts occasionally. You know, you like to exchange gifts with people. So you want to be able to preserve a relationship that people develop. But you don't want to be able to have gifts being used as a way that you can essentially buy a vote or influence a vote. So it's a fine line, and it's going to require, I think, not only some new legislation, but also some better discretion on the part of people who would give gifts as well as the people who would take gifts.
So many people listening, I would think most who pay attention to the news, the current events, are aware of what happened with Governor McDonald. Former Governor McDonald, and which seems to have been what is leading to the discussion of better ethics in our politics. But even as Governor McAuliffe comes and talks about putting this panel together, which he's done, to decide what is a good law and what's not a good law, what right. You should be allowed to know, what you shouldn't be allowed to do, there are some people from both sides of our political wall saying, you can talk about what you want to do there, but that doesn't mean we have to pass this into legislation.
Yeah, and of course, that's always the fine line, too. I mean, what Governor McDonald did has been determined in a court of law to be a crime. It's not just ethical transgression. The court has determined that to be a crime. Whether you or I believe that is true or not, in some ways doesn't matter anymore because the court's made that determination. But it's really hard to legislate good ethical behavior because people always try to figure out a way around a law. Now, what we can do, I think, is you put good laws in place, better laws than we have right now, and people will try to get around them, but at least we have a better set of standards that we have said, look, this is what we think is appropriate and what's not appropriate, and hopefully you will comply. You will report the things that you get as gifts. You will report your campaign contributions. You will report this, that, or the other thing. We can't force them to do it. We can put enforcement mechanisms in place, but a lot of this is going to fall on the individual legislator to do the right thing and know what the right thing is.
And for many folks, I have friends who are both very strong Democrats and very strong Republicans. And so when Governor McDonnell was found to have committed a crime, the Democrats all spoke up and took a very biased viewpoint, became very pious about it. But see, that's the problem over there. The Republicans always pro-money and trying to help everybody among their friends, but not the larger good. But much of what started the ethical conversation had to do with State Senator Philip Puckett, who was a Democrat. Do you want to share the story?
Well, it's a very interesting story, and it really is bound up with the whole debate about whether we're going to get Medicaid expansion in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Last session, at least as the session began, the Democrats had a one-vote margin in the Senate, arising out of the fact that the Senate was split equally between Republicans and Democrats 20-20, and the lieutenant governor got to cast the deciding vote. He was a Democrat, so the Democrats could control things. Now, as we got into this logjam, the House Republicans didn't support Medicaid expansion. The Senate, a couple of Republicans supported Medicaid expansion there, so there were enough votes in the Senate to get it passed. The governor had a plan for how we were going to get Medicaid expansion enacted as part of the budget. And coming up to the last week of the session, looked like there was a possibility that would occur. And then all of a sudden, Senator Puckett, who's a Democrat out of the Southwest, Democrat in the Senate, just resigns without any notice to anybody, and presumably resigns for a couple of reasons, one of which is to allow his daughter to get a judgeship, because there's some kind of unspoken rule in the Senate. You can't appoint a sitting member's relative to be a judge. And he gets offered a job with the Tobacco Commission in Southwest Virginia, getting paid a whole lot of money to do work for the Tobacco Commission. So he resigns in the last week, and at that point, the Democrats no longer have control of the Senate, and Medicaid expansion then becomes dead. Now, the question was he offered something to do an official act, i.e. resign, and therefore is his action similar to what Governor McDonald did? Whatever happened, clearly he was the one who allowed Medicaid expansion to go down. And he could have waited a week. If he had waited a week, the Democratic votes would have been there in the Senate to pass Medicaid expansion. So, you know, Senator Puckett, because of his actions, probably doomed Medicaid expansion in the Commonwealth of Virginia, got a lot of people angry. He is a Democrat, but presumably he was offered a job by a Republican who controls the Tobacco Commission.
David Toscano here with us today. He represents Charlottesville and Albemarle, 57th District, in the Virginia House of Delegates. Now, we talk about whether or not or what effect stepping down and accepting another job had on the Medicaid expansion. And much of what happened initially was blamed on Mr. Puckett and the Republicans who supposedly talked him into taking this. But am I right in my memory that after the initial emails were found, that there were other emails found from Governor McAuliffe or representatives of Governor McAuliffe asking similar actions be taken, like, wait a week and we'll do this.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. The way this happened was that Governor McAuliffe got wind of this resignation on a Friday night, and right away, you know, the telephone lines get lit up because they knew exactly what was going to happen if Senator Puckett resigned. And the chief staffer for McAuliffe called Puckett. I think Tim Kaine called Puckett. So did Warner call Puckett. And, you know, they were trying to plead with him not to go. And, you know, what can we do to make you not leave? You know, so it sounds like they were making similar kinds of offers. The question is how direct they were about an exact job for him or for his daughter or not. But it does lead to the impression, you know, that the Democrats are trying to do it too. My sense of it was they were trying to get him to stay for at least a week so you could get this critical vote done. And they were sort of scurrying around to try to do what they could. And of course, after he was finally quit forever, Governor McAuliffe was very angry because he knew exactly what it meant for Medicaid expansion.
David Toscano with us today, 11:16 here on the Wake Up Call. Be right back.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Ting Mobile. That's T-I-N-G. You may not have heard of Ting Mobile, but people in Virginia use Ting for their mobile services. No contracts, pay for what you use plans, and reliable customer service. Ting works with your existing phone. You can learn more and see an average monthly bill at ting.com.
The Frontier Culture Museum, currently celebrating 26 years of bringing the past to life through historical interpretation of how the American frontier was formed. The Frontier Culture Museum is located at the intersection of I-81 and I-64 in Stanton, Virginia. Information at frontiermuseum.org.
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at t-nprinting.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today here on WNRN Independent Community Radio. Our guest today, the Democratic leader at the Virginia House of Delegates, David Toscano. David, once again, thanks for being here today. I'm sure you are a busy man, if not just for the holidays, the fact that the next session begins in 5 weeks.
Everybody's coming to you, asking you to put in legislation about this, that, and the other thing, and they're trying to enlighten you about their legislative package for the upcoming year. You know, I represent two jurisdictions, Charlottesville and Albemarle, who are always very creative in what they want to see happen in Richmond. And, you know, you're scurrying around trying to put these bills in and get ready for the session.
Well, I want to get in a few minutes into some of the bills that you plan to bring forth. One of the ones that has been made public already has to do with sexual assault. So let's talk about sexual assault first, and then we'll get into that bill and some others you plan to bring forth. So we know I believe everyone is familiar with what's happened at the University of Virginia with that Rolling Stone article. Right. And then many people are familiar or probably now have heard that Rolling Stone has sort of taken a step back and said, we didn't do a good job, and we think that this woman, Jackie, may be making up some of this. Does that affect where things are going to go in the legislature in terms of talking about sexual assault? Because you heard many people come up and say, yes, we're going to talk about that in 2015. But now that the truth of the of what happened has been diminished a little bit. Do you think that it will also diminish the importance of immediate action in the legislature?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, we've had a really terrible fall here in Charlottesville.
Yes, we have.
Hannah Graham and then this Rolling Stone article. And I think many of your listeners, when I read that article, I was absolutely outraged and flabbergasted that, you know, something like that might have occurred and that nobody would have reported it to the authorities. And now you've got this partial retraction, and no one's really quite sure whether it's partial or total or what it means. But the sad part about it is it plays into the stereotypes that some people have about sexual assault, that a number of these things are fabricated, these reports, which are that's totally at odds with the factual studies that are done that show that, you know, most sexual assaults that are reported actually did occur. And the problem, I think, with this one is because it was never reported to law enforcement at the time it occurred, you really couldn't get a good investigation happening. And when that occurs, then you've got the possibility of a later report emerging that has embellishments that didn't occur or certain things that are factually incorrect. It throws the whole thing, a monkey wrench in the whole
discussion. But may have still taken place, but just not on that date or at that hour.
Or quite the same way.
Right.
I absolutely believe something occurred that was very, very serious. Now, what exactly it was and what level of crime it is not clear to me. I would hope that people will continue to focus on the fact that rape is a serious problem in the society generally, especially on college campuses, and that the way we are approaching it right now is not working the way we want it to. And that is that a number of people who perpetrate the crime are not being caught and being punished for their transgression.
Well, I want to talk about your bill in just a second, but for people who are questioning the severity of the crime, I think many people believe that something took place with this Rolling Stone article and Jackie, or even if you've decided that that was a completely fictitious story, many people, yourself, myself, believe that if not that case, there are others, whatever number you want to put in front of that, that have taken place.
Right.
So let's talk about the atmosphere in which those take place. There's been mention about more policing of Rugby Road fraternities in terms of alcohol being served to underage students.
That should be done, and it's up to the city council and the police department. Well, I assume that Chief Longo is going to do more of that now. I mean, periodically they beef up patrols in that area anyway. But I think in light of what's happened, I think you're going to see more police operations in that area. Remember, this allegation occurred on private property. It wasn't university property. So this jurisdiction is clearly within the city police department. So you can patrol those areas. And if people are drinking, you know, you can stop it.
This is not, in your mind, this has not yet reached the stage of, or at least the underage drinking is not a state legislature issue yet.
Well, it is to the extent that we determine what the appropriate age is. But in terms of enforcement, it's not like we're going to put state police on the streets of Charlottesville to police underage drinking. But the locality can step up and say, okay, we're going to put more patrols in this area periodically to make sure that there's not underage drinking or that these houses are not becoming, places where people do drink who are underage and potentially put these houses under severe, penalties for doing what they're doing.
How about, should there be some thought put into requiring the university, the fraternity, sorority, the Greek system to be more under the university umbrella.
And that, you know, that's been an issue since I've been in elective office. You know, I served on the city council for 12 years, and it was periodically a huge issue. The university in the 80s decided that they were essentially going to allow the fraternities to become more independent. And I think there may be some efforts underway to put some more constraints on fraternities and their certifications as student organizations. I don't think that will be a state issue. I think that will be something that will be internal to the university. I think the state issues come into place and whether we're going to force people to report these crimes who become aware of it. You know, for people who are minors, if certain folks become aware that a minor is being abused by a parent, by a school teacher, by anybody else, there is a mandatory reporting requirement to the social services department. But when somebody becomes a major over 18, you know, there are no such mandatory reporting requirements. So, but for one day, somebody would have to report by law a rape of a minor. But if a person is over 18, you don't have to report it. I think you're going to see some effort in the legislature to require certain university administrators to report rapes and violent sexual assaults to local police departments in a timely fashion so they can investigate them.
David Descano here with us. He's the Democratic leader in the Virginia House of Delegates, talking about a variety of things, currently about the sexual assault and the issues surrounding that taking place at the University of Virginia. Now, you have put forth, or you have discussed, wanting to talk about this once the legislature starts. There have been several delegates and state senators who have talked about how they're going to put forth an immediate bill, including Rob Bell, who represents much of the Charlottesville, Albemarle area. So give us, what are you going to do? What are your thoughts?
Sure. Well, you know, when this incident became public, I immediately said, look, this is serious enough that we've got to get the legislature on this. And the way you do that is have hearings. And a good time to have hearings is when we're in session the first week, because we don't do a lot in the first week. So let's get the House Courts of Justice and the Senate Courts of Justice committees together. Let's look at the protocols for universities and how they report these incidents to law enforcement. Because all of these universities should have protocols. They should have procedures for doing this. And this is not a problem unique to UVA. William & Mary is under federal scrutiny, too, and so are other universities around the Commonwealth. So why don't we see what all of these universities or colleges are doing and see whether we need to step in and pass legislation? Since that time, I've gotten an agreement from the chairman of the House Courts of Justice to have at least a House Courts Committee meeting on this issue. The Senate, for some reason, is balking a little bit, even though individual senators have supported the notion of hearings. So that's what I did right out of the box, and then I immediately had a bill drafted that would require university administrators to report the sexual assault and rape cases to the local police authority so they can investigate these.
But why does that, or why is that, or would be treated differently than just a private citizen who's not required to do that? Or at least I don't believe they're required to do that. And so now we step into the issue of a citizen and their health issues becoming more public.
Yeah, and I think that's where you're going to get some pushback. There are a number of people, victims' rights folks, sexual assault resource agency kind of entities that say, you know, they'd argue, Mr. Toscano, if you do this, what you're going to do is discourage people from reporting. And I'm very mindful of that. But I guess my counter to that is the way it's happening now is not working, because there are a lot, you know, not just this incident at UVA, but now we're, a lot of other people have come forward and said, I was raped too, and I never got justice either. So maybe we need to try something a little bit different. And if it's not all university administrators, maybe it's a small group of university administrators. Because maybe you want to give some safety to a victim to, say, go to student health and be able to talk to a counselor at student health about what happened without having that person have to report. But if you go to the dean of students, you know, maybe they should have to report.
Is the bill designed to bring a supposed perpetrator to court, or is it designed to provide greater information to universities, families, local police agencies?
That's a good question. It is not designed to force people to go into court. And in fact, victims of sexual abuse and sexual assault have a lot of control in the process about whether or not and how to go to court. The Commonwealth's attorney's offices around the Commonwealth, you know full well the sort of victimization process that goes on with women who are raped. You know, first they're raped, they're victimized there, and then they can be victimized by the court system. So victims have a lot of say. What my bill is going to do is get the police on this right away, and so as to give the victim more options. Because if you wait and you don't collect the evidence right off the bat or do your investigation right away, you lose some critical elements of the case that may make it very difficult for you to prosecute later on if you decide to do so.
David Toscano with us today here on the Wake Up Call, 11:32. You're welcome to call up. I sort of haven't given out the phone number because I had lots of questions. Melissa is out there, 434-979-0919, if you have a question for Representative Toscano. So we talked about that bill and the conversation that you want to have at the start of the 2015 legislature. What else do you have going on? What else is in your plans for 2015?
Well, you know, Rick, it's kind of ironic. I don't usually introduce a lot of criminal justice bills because it's been a long time since I did a lot of criminal law.
But you are on the members of the Courts of Justice Committee, correct?
Yes, I am. And I'm on the what they call the Civil Law Subcommittee, which is the subcommittee of courts that deals with the civil stuff, you know, domestic relations, insurance, malpractice, that sort of thing. I also vote on a number of criminal justice bills, but I don't usually put them in. And this year I've got two of them, and they're two big ones. This reporting bill, which will go to the criminal law subcommittee. And then I've got a bill that really is related to the Hannah Graham case, which is an effort to expand the DNA database in the Commonwealth such that we take DNA from people who have been convicted of a category of misdemeanors, more serious misdemeanor crimes, not traffic offenses, not violations of Freedom of Information Act or anything like that, but things like assault, peeping Tom, larceny, those kinds of things. And the theory behind this bill, again, is that if we had had this database, it's quite possible that Jesse Matthew would never have met Hannah Graham, because his DNA would have been taken when he'd been convicted of a couple of misdemeanors years ago. And then when the alleged rape in Fairfax occurred that he's alleged perpetrator on, they would have compared the DNA at that point. They would have gotten a hit, and they would have probably arrested him at that point in time. He might have been convicted of that crime, and he would have never been walking on the mall that night.
What do you, one of the things that has always, you know, it just seems to be truth, whether you like it or dislike it, is that when something is immediately in the news, it gets a lot of attention. And as something fades from front page conversation, you sort of get the shrug. And so, by the time this comes around, and let's say mid-January to late January, it will have been 4 months since Hannah Graham's initial gone missing. And then how many people say, you know, good idea, but my constituency is more concerned about this?
Oh, I absolutely. This happens all the time. And, you know, think about the urgency surrounding the aftermath of the Virginia Tech incident with guns. Think about the urgency surrounding what happened to Senator Deeds with his son. And think about how some of the impetus for gun legislation has gone away because Virginia Tech is a long ways in the past. And some of the urgency for mental health reform has not gone away as much, but has kind of faded away a little bit because it's now been over a year since that tragic incident with Gus Deeds and his dad. So you know, if there is an idea that it's a good idea, sometimes you have to move fast when the public is paying attention to it, try to get it enacted because you realize that you may lose some ability to get something passed if you don't move fast.
Now, Virginia is one of the smaller number of states that have what I call the seasonal legislature. You meet in January, February, possibly March of the year, and then the rest of the year you only get together for more important gatherings or specific calendarized gatherings, budget issues, etc. So do you think that is a pro or a con when you're talking about putting through and discussing potential laws, such as this case? If you had had Virginia Tech's issue, Virginia Tech's gun frightening incident took place in April. And so it was another 9 to 10 months before the legislature got together to talk about potential bills regarding that. Hannah Graham takes place in September. So we have to wait 3 to 4 months before potential laws can go forth about that. Is that a con? We should be able to, because we're meeting next week or in 2 weeks and it's still in the news, we can put out good, strong bills? Or is that a pro because we're not reacting to something that's immediately a headline?
Yeah, it's both a pro and a con. You know, you hate to say it that way, Rick, but it really is. I mean, in Virginia, we've always had this tradition of a citizen legislature. For those of your listeners who are not aware, you know, we begin our session every January, the second Wednesday in January. And in the even years, we go for 60 days. And in the odd years, we go for 45 days. And we're supposed to be done at that point in time. Now, you know, we're never really done by that point in time because we always have these special sessions and they seem to come with increasing regularity. But we're supposed to be done. And the principle behind a citizen legislature is twofold. One is you get to think and consider things over a longer period of time. And two is that you go back, and this is the most important thing, and you live in your regular community and you interact with your constituents on a regular basis. You're not isolated in quite the same way as, say, the Congress is that's in session all the time. That is a really good thing. It does force some of us to be challenged in terms of how we make a living because, you know, I'm a lawyer, and if I'm away for 60 days, you know, I have to meet clients on weekends and at night. It's kind of a challenge. But by and large, I think a citizen legislature is a good thing. It does have the effect, I think, of making it more difficult to, shall we say, strike while the iron is hot to get something passed when it's in the news.
David Toscano with us here on the Wake Up Call. We'll be back shortly.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of independent music radio.
The American Shakespeare Center, playing this holiday season at the world's only recreation of Shakespeare's Blackfriars Playhouse, The 12 Dates of Christmas, The Santaland Diaries, and A Christmas Carol. Coming in January, it's The Taming of the Shrew and The Rover. AmericanShakespeareCenter.com.
Orzo Kitchen and Wine Bar, Seaville Weekly Reader's choice for Mediterranean cuisine in Charlottesville's Main Street Market. Orzo focuses on farm-to-table recipes and serves over 30 wines by the glass. Orzo does catering and can host your next event. You can make reservations for lunch or dinner at orzokitchen.com or 434-975-ORZO. Always with parking.
Price Hyundai on 29 North. From Hyundai, it's the new Sonata Hybrid, 38 miles per gallon highway, and breakthrough lithium polymer technology. Also the 38 miles per gallon highway Elantra. You can find out more at jimpricehyundai.com.
Hi, I'm Gary Hart from Almar Ballet Theater and Studio for the Performing Arts. You are invited to our annual presentation of the Nutcracker Suite, performed in Almar Ballet's Intimate Theater in downtown Crozet, December 6th, 7th, 13th, and 14th. Proceeds from this show, co-produced by Studio for the Performing Arts, support our local need-based scholarship program, Dancing Off the Streets. Following each performance, you can meet and take photos with the dancers under the theater lights. Performers include dance students training at ABT, local actress Anastasia Brakovska, and Ashley Geisler. Veronica Hart, director of Concordance Contemporary, performs as the Sugar Plum Fairy. The Nutcracker Suite is suited for the entire family. Seating is limited to only 40 people per show. For more information, including tickets, aballet.org. I'm Gary Hart, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And welcome back to WNRN. David Toscano and I chatting a little bit about what we do during whatever free time we have. David, talk about some of the other bills that you have coming up in 2015. You mentioned the sexual assault issue, but you have a couple others that are really important.
Oh, well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about that. You know, one of the big things that's happening in Virginia is we are having some budgetary problems, largely because of what's happening in Washington. We've become so dependent on defense spending and federal procurement that with the sequestration in D.C. and the cuts to those spending programs, we're not coming out of the recession as fast and as robustly as Virginia usually does. So we've got some budget problems. So in an effort to try to find a little more money, I have put in a bill to get rid of what's called the coal tax credit. This is a tax credit that was enacted many years ago, designed to encourage more coal production in Virginia and create more jobs for coal miners in Virginia. It costs the Commonwealth almost $100 million a year. You know, it depends on the year, but sometimes it's 70, sometimes it's 80, sometimes it'd be close to $90 million a year. This is money that is never appropriated in a budget. It just happens because once you pass a tax credit, it exists until you get rid of it, and nobody adjusts it every single year. So finding that money taking that money, putting it back in the budget will help us with public safety, schools, and the like. My bill actually redirects the money so that it's spent for economic development in Southwest Virginia, rather than to go into the pockets of a small number of coal companies or utility companies that benefit by the credit right now. You know, that's independent of the whole global warming issue, but that is one of the bills I've got. I've got a couple of solar bills that I think are kind of interesting, and hopefully I can get some traction on.
How much trading do you have to do to get bills? Because I would think that immediately, folks, or certainly leadership from west of Interstate 81 are going to say no way to your coal bill, because all you have to do is say coal and no or against, and they don't even read the rest of it.
Yeah, well, you know, there may be some trading on some of these tax credit bills. One of the things that has been occurring in Virginia over the last 20 years is we've been enacting these tax credits for this, that, and the other thing, and we're not really sure they work the way they're supposed to be working. And so they go to benefit a certain constituency, and it's going to be harder just to take one and get rid of one. You may have to try to get rid of a whole slew of them, and there may be some trade-offs. There may be some tax credits I do like that I might be willing to sacrifice to some extent to get rid of a tax credit that I don't like this coal credit. And we'll just have to see. There's not as much horse trading as you might think in the General Assembly, but it does go on in order to try to get things done.
When you pick a bill to initiate, to submit, or one that's out there waiting for you to vote on, do you ever put your beliefs for the good of the state, the good of the nation, ahead of what your constituency might be saying they would prefer you to vote, how they would like you to vote for it?
Yeah, that's always a dilemma for a delegate. I mean, do you vote all the time with your constituency of the district you represent, or sometimes do you have to step out and say, well, look, you know, you may not think this is in all of our best interests, but in point of fact, it is. And so I'm going to vote for this. And, you know, I haven't been in that situation very often, but there are occasionally some bills that, you know, I've had to vote for. Say I might have to vote for a budget that doesn't reflect all my priorities, but it needs a vote in order to get passed. The transportation bill of a couple of years ago is a good example of that, because I did not like the way that transportation bill was written, but I thought we had to have more revenue for transportation. And so I voted for that bill, even though I would have preferred to have the money all raised from increasing the gas tax rather than to take money from the so-called general fund, which is the fund that funds education, public safety, and the like.
Wes called in, but you can call in. I know I haven't gotten out the phone number very often during the hour, 434-979-0919. We got a call from Wes. We were talking about while the iron is hot, and Wes wanted to remind both of us, David, that striking while the iron is hot on various bills, Wes believes that many times there are already adequate laws on the books. And so I didn't realize that he was already on the phone. Wes, you with me? Oh, well. Sorry, Wes. But hopefully I passed on that question properly, or that comment properly.
And he's absolutely right. I mean, you don't want to legislate just for the heck of it.
Not enforced properly? Or?
Yeah, it could be an enforcement problem. And sometimes, you know, bad facts make bad laws. And sometimes you just have to get people in a room and say, are you going to do this differently than you've been doing it in the past? If so, we don't need a law to put on the books to force you to do it.
All right, Wes, sorry about that. I hope I put your comment out there properly. David, let's talk for a minute again. Our guest, David Toscano, 57th District of Charlottesville and part of Albemarle County, serving his fifth term. He's the Democratic leader in the Virginia House of Delegates, which new session starts January 14th. Another issue that's come up, decriminalization of marijuana. I saw where a state senator, Adam Eben
from Alexandria has put that bill in.
Has put forth, right, to decriminalize it. Instead of current possession is $500 fine and 30 days in jail, and he wants to change it to a civil instead of a criminal issue where it's a fine of $100 and does not make your criminal record. Your thoughts on that?
I think it's a good idea. It will never get out. It'll never get to the House. And if it gets to the House, it will never get to the House floor. I'll never have a chance to vote on that bill. You know, it is small amounts should be decriminalized, I think. I mean, dealers, I mean, is a different issue, but.
Hey, Wes, are you with me?
I'm here. Are you with me?
I'm here, too, and you're on the air. Your comment or question for Delegate Toscano.
You were speaking a while ago about passing legislation in the wake of large-scale events such as Anagram or Virginia Tech, and it's in my opinion, that that is possibly the worst time to pass legislation because due to the high tensions that run logic and restraint are often thrown out the window, and hubris and other emotions that don't serve the legislative process prevail. And I would bet that in most cases there are already adequate laws on the books that would handle any situation. Especially with regards to Virginia Tech. And as tragic as the situations are, passing further laws, as I, so, sorry, that's my bird that's weighing in on this subject, passing laws in this heat of the moment, as I told the phone screener, only serves to drive another picket in the fence of laws around us. In all of these cases, Virginia has adequate laws, yet we feel compelled to pass further laws in the wake of Virginia Tech, and now we're passing further laws, speaking of passing further laws in the wake of the tragedy of Hannah Graham. Why?
Hey, Wes, thank you very much. Really great comments.
Yeah, a great comment, and I think you have to be very mindful of what he said. That's part of why we have a deliberative process in the legislature. That's part of why I was trying to get hearings on the sexual assault issue at a point where we could kind of carefully think about it. The other thing that happens often with legislation is that you have a bill that you introduce, and maybe people have enough questions about it. They think the concept might make sense, but they want to take a look at it more carefully. So they would refer the bill to a commission that already exists. We have in Virginia the Virginia Crime Commission. And a lot of criminal justice bills that are a little unique go to that commission so that people can take a close look at it over a period of time so you don't run into the situation that Wes mentioned. Some of these things are pretty new, like the DNA expansion of the DNA database. Some libertarians have concerns about that because, you know, you are, impinging on somebody's rights when you take a sample of DNA. It's not as much of an intrusion as you might think because all it is taking a swab from the inside of your cheek, but it is collecting more data. And some libertarians, you know, get really worried about that. And so you got to make sure that you take your time and consider all of people's views before you pass the legislation.
Great, Wes. I really appreciate your call for that. David Toscano here on the wake-up call. It's 11:53. David, we were talking about the decriminalization of marijuana. You seem to agree with the thought of the bill, but said it would never go anywhere.
I don't think it'll go anywhere. My guess is that it will not get out of a Senate committee, and there it's been introduced in the Senate. So the way this works is that for it to get over to the House, it's got to come out of a Senate committee. It's got to be voted on by the Senate. The majority has to support it there. Then it comes over to the House. It's got to get out of a subcommittee and a committee in the House to get to the House floor. I just don't think there's enough sentiment in the legislature to change this. So that I just don't think I'll see this bill.
Is this because of the constituency of the state of Virginia or the representatives in the state Senate?
I think it's pretty much the representatives in the state Senate and especially the representatives in the House. Again, here we go. We're back to where we started at the hour, and that is redistricting. The House is a very conservative body because of the way redistricting works. The irony is that in the last several statewide elections, Democrats have won almost all those races, not by a huge amount, but they have won almost all those races. So it's pretty much a toss-up state, 50%, 51% Democratic in the last few races. But look at the House of Delegates. House of Delegates is 68% Republican. How can you explain that other than by saying the districts are drawn to favor the Republicans. So what you got is a House that is pretty much controlled by rural, more conservative Republicans. This is probably an issue that would be more greater support within urban areas and more suburban areas.
Just a few minutes left. Let me do this after all my hard work. I want to, I'm a lobbyist, and I want to represent a couple groups if we have time to do more than one or two. Virginia Farm Bureau. I'm with the Virginia Farm Bureau, and I want to talk about the use of biosolids, which for those who aren't aware is pretty much recycled poop spread on your farmland.
Great way of putting it.
And I want to tell you, Mr. Toscano, that farmers need nutrients on their farmland to help crops and pasture land to grow and thrive. Biosolids is the ultimate use of a recycled product that helps provide those nutrients for crops and pasture. Now, this is off their website, by the way. This is off the website the Virginia Farm Bureau.
That's perfect because it's a great talking point. I mean, how many people could argue with the notion that we're using recyclable goods, putting nutrients in the soil, and we're going to grow more things? Nobody can disagree with that. But as we say in the legislature, the devil is always in the details. And what does a bill look like, and what effect does it have? So you start asking yourself, okay, what is the nature of these biosolids, and what happens when they're put in a field? How do they run off into streams, if at all? Are they going to contaminate the Chesapeake Bay? Are they going to have effect on our wildlife or our water? And so when you get a statement like that, you say, yeah, I agree with that. But then you look at a bill and you get experts to come in and testify. You get citizens to come in and testify as to how the bill is either going to help them or hurt them.
Right. The farmer may want to do it, but the guy, the waterman out of Gloucester.
May not. Yeah. And so that's where the balancing act comes in. And you make all these choices all the time on these individual bills based on the best information you have at the time.
All right. So now I'm with the Virginia Education Association. I'm going to talk about education versus incarceration. Did you know that Virginia ranks 39th in the state per pupil funding from K through 12? However, our state ranks 13th in state correction expenditures per offender. Is this an accurate reflection of our priorities? Sensible sentencing reform could reduce costs associated with incarceration and free up funding for our schools. And you are a member of the Courts of Justice Committee.
Yeah, and I agree with that statement, too. And I think that if you look at places where we can free up some money, we can look to criminal justice. And certainly you have to put the bad guys away. There's no doubt about that. But we have been moving towards a system in Virginia that puts people in jail for longer periods of time and penalizes them with greater fines, with the result that when they get out, and a lot of them get out, they're so behind the eight ball that oftentimes they go back to their old behaviors. Especially in the juvenile area, there is so much we could do to reform juveniles so that they can become productive members of society. And this finds its form in the budget. The budget is a reflection of our priorities. If our priority is education, we're going to spend more on education. If it's an incarceration, we're going to spend more on incarceration.
David, just looks like about 60 seconds left. Do you plan to run for state senator at any time or take on going to Washington, D.C.?
You know, I like what I'm doing now. You know, I've got a great job. I represent a great community. The leadership position in the House is a very interesting role to have. It gives me access and influence on folks in the governor's office that I may not have if I was in a different position. So I'm sticking here right now. We'll see what the future brings.
It's a washy way to answer that question.
As always.
You know, maybe. I don't know. I like what I'm doing, but you never know. Well, I'm very glad to have you in today. I think many people in our area appreciate what you're doing as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Have me on often.
David Toscano here today as our guest. Next week, UVA Professor Ed Murphy will be here talking about life beyond Earth and future of commercial spaceflight. Les Temps Perdue, up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by the markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Max Cecilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.